Chapter 20. Ain't to do with him now then surely nobody else would. That was clear. The police, keeping their eye on him, would hasten to warn every employer inclined to give him a chance. He felt suddenly very helpless, alarmed and idle, and he followed the middle-aged man to the estaminet round the corner, where he met some other good companions. They assured him that he would not be allowed to starve, work or no work. They had drinks all round to the discomfiture of all employers of labor, and to the destruction of society. He sat biting his lower lip. "That is, monsieur, how I became a companion," he said. The hand he passed over his forehead was trembling. All the same, there's something wrong in the world, where a man can get lost for a glass more or less. He never looked up, though I could see he was getting excited under his dejection. He slapped the bench with his open palm. "No," he cried. It was an impossible existence. Watched by the police, watched by the comrades, I did not belong to myself anymore. Why, I could not even go to draw a few francs from my savings bank without a comrade hanging about the door to see that I didn't bolt. And most of them were neither more nor less than housebreakers. Unintelligent, I mean. They robbed the rich. They were only getting back their own, they said. When I had had some drink I believed them. There were also the fools and the mad. Des exults quoi. When I was drunk I loved them. When I got more drink I was angry with the world. That was the best time. I found refuge from misery and rage. But one can't be always drunk, n'est ce pas, monsieur? And when I was sober I was afraid to break away. They would have stuck me like a pig. He folded his arms again, and raised his sharp chin with a bitter smile. By and by they told me it was time to go to work. The work was to rob a bank. Afterwards a bomb would be thrown to wreck the place. My beginner's part would be to keep watch in a street at the back, and to take care of a black bag with the bomb inside till it was wanted. After the meeting at which the affair was arranged, a trusty comrade did not leave me an inch. I had not dared to protest. I was afraid of being done away with quietly in that room. Only, as we were walking together, I wondered whether it would not be better for me to throw myself suddenly into the Seine. But while I was turning it over in my mind, we had crossed the bridge, and afterwards I had not the opportunity. In the light of the candle end, with his sharp features, fluffy little mustache, and oval face, he looked at times delicately and gaily young, and then appeared quite old, decrepit, full of sorrow, pressing his folded arms to his breast. As he remained silent, I felt bound to ask, "Well, and how did it end?" "Deportation to Caen," he answered. He seemed to think that somebody had given the plot away. As he was keeping watch in the back street, bag in hand, he was set upon by the police. These imbeciles had knocked him down without noticing what he had in his hand. He wondered how the bomb failed to explode as he fell. But it didn't explode. "I tried to tell my story in court," he continued. The president was amused. There were in the audience some idiots who laughed. I expressed the hope that some of his companions had been caught too. He shuddered slightly before he told me that there were two Simon, called also Biscuit, the middle-aged fitter who spoke to him in the street, and a fellow of the name of Maffle, one of the sympathetic strangers who had applauded his sentiments and consoled his humanitarian sorrows when he got drunk in the café. "Yes," he went on, with an effort, "I had the advantage of their company over there on St. Joseph's Island, amongst some 80 or 90 other convicts. We were all classed as dangerous. St. Joseph's Island is the prettiest of the Isles de Salut. It is rocky and green, with shallow ravines, bushes, thickets, groves of mango trees, and many feathery palms. Six warders armed with revolvers and carbines are in charge of the convicts kept there. An eight-oared galley keeps up the communication in the daytime, across a channel a quarter of a mile wide, with the Isle Royale, where there is a military post. She makes the first trip at 6 in the morning. At 4 in the afternoon her service is over, and she is then hauled up into a little dock on the Isle Royale, and a sentry put over her, and a few smaller boats. From that time till next morning the island of St. Joseph remains cut off from the rest of the world, with the warders patrolling in turn the path from the warder's house to the convict huts, and a multitude of sharks patrolling the waters all round. Under these circumstances the convicts planned a mutiny. Such a thing had never been known in the penitentiary's history before. But their plan was not without some possibility of success. The warders were to be taken by surprise and murdered during the night. Their arms would enable the convicts to shoot down the people in the galley as she came alongside in the morning. The galley once in their possession, other boats were to be captured, and the whole company was to row away up the coast. At dusk the two warders on duty mustered the convicts as usual. Then they proceeded to inspect the huts to ascertain that everything was in order. And the second they entered they were set upon, and absolutely smothered under the numbers of their assailants. The twilight faded rapidly. It was a new moon, and a heavy black squall gathering over the coast increased the profound darkness of the night. The convicts assembled in the open space, deliberating upon the next step to be taken, argued amongst themselves in low voices. "You took part in all this?" I asked. "No. I knew what was going to be done, of course. But why should I kill these warders? I had nothing against them. But I was afraid of the others. Whatever happened, I could not escape from them. I sat alone on the stump of a tree with my head in my hands, sick at heart at the thought of a freedom that could be nothing but a mockery to me. Suddenly I was startled to perceive the shape of a man on the path nearby. He stood perfectly still, then his form became effaced in the night. It must have been the chief warder coming to see what had become of his two men. No one noticed him. The convicts kept on quarreling over their plans. The leaders could not get themselves obeyed. The fierce whispering of that dark mass of men was very horrible. At last they divided into two parties and moved off. When they had passed me I rose, weary and hopeless. The path to the warder's house was dark and silent, but on each side the bushes rustled slightly. Presently I saw a faint thread of light before me. The chief warder, followed by his three men, was approaching cautiously. But he had failed to close his dark lantern properly. The convicts had seen that faint gleam too. There was an awful savage yell, a turmoil on the dark path, shots fired, blows, groans. And with the sound of smashed bushes, the shouts of the pursuers and the screams of the pursued, the manhunt, the warder hunt, passed by me into the interior of the island. I was alone. And I assure you, monsieur, I was indifferent to everything. After standing still for a while, I walked on along the path till I kicked something hard. I stooped and picked up a warder's revolver. I felt with my fingers that it was loaded in five chambers. In the gusts of wind I heard the convicts calling to each other far away, and then a roll of thunder would cover the soughing and rustling of the trees. Suddenly, a big light ran across my path very low along the ground, and it showed a woman's skirt with the edge of an apron. I knew that the person who carried it must be the wife of the head warder. They had forgotten all about her, it seems. A shot rang out in the interior of the island, and she cried out to herself as she ran. She passed on. I followed, and presently I saw her again. She was pulling at the cord of the big bell which hangs at the end of the landing pier, with one hand, and with the other she was swinging the heavy lantern to and fro. This is the agreed signal for the Isle Royale should assistance be required at night. The wind carried the sound away from our island and the light she swung was hidden on the shore side by the few trees that grow near the warder's house. I came up quite close to her from behind. She went on without stopping, without looking aside, as though she had been all alone on the island. A brave woman, monsieur. I put the revolver inside the breast of my blue blouse and waited. A flash of lightning and a clap of thunder destroyed both the sound and the light of the signal for an instant, but she never faltered, pulling at the cord and swinging the lantern as regularly as a machine. She was a comely woman of 30, no more. I thought to myself, all that's no good on a night like this. And I made up my mind that if a body of my fellow convicts came down to the pier, which was sure to happen soon, I would shoot her through the head before I shot myself. I knew the comrades well. This idea of mine gave me quite an interest in life, monsieur, and at once, instead of remaining stupidly exposed on the pier, I retreated a little way and crouched behind a bush. I did not intend to let myself be pounced upon unawares, and be prevented perhaps from rendering a supreme service to at least one human creature, before I died myself. But we must believe the signal was seen, for the galley from Isle Royale came over in an astonishingly short time. The woman kept right until the light of her lantern flashed upon the officer in command, and the bayonets of the soldiers in the boat. Then she sat down, and began to cry. She didn't need me anymore. I did not budge. Some soldiers were only in their shirt sleeves, others without boots, just as the call to arms had found them. They passed by my bush at the double. The galley had been sent away for more, and the woman sat all alone crying at the end of the pier, with the lantern standing on the ground near her. Then suddenly I saw in the light at the end of the pier the red pantaloons of two more men. I was overcome with astonishment. They, too, started off at a run. Their tunics flapped unbuttoned, and they were bareheaded. One of them panted out to the other, "Straight on, straight on." Where on earth did they spring from, I wondered. Slowly I walked down the short pier. I saw the woman's form shaken by sobs, and heard her moaning more and more distinctly, "Oh, my man, my poor man, my poor man." I stole on quietly. She could neither hear nor see anything. She had thrown her apron over her head, and was rocking herself to and fro in her grief. But I remarked a small boat fastened to the end of the pier. Those two men, they looked like South officers, must have come in it, after being too late, I suppose, for the galley. It is incredible that they should have thus broken the regulations from a sense of duty. And it was a stupid thing to do. I could not believe my eyes in the very moment I was stepping into that boat. I pulled along the shore slowly. A black cloud hung over the Isles de Salut. I heard firing, shouts. Another hunt had begun, the convict hunt. The oars were too long to pull comfortably. I managed them with difficulty, though the boat herself was light. But when I got round to the other side of the island, the squall broke in rain and wind. I was unable to make head against it. I let the boat drift ashore and secured her. I knew the spot. There was a tumble-down old hovel standing near the water. Cowering in there, I heard through the noises of the wind and the falling downpour some people tearing through the bushes. They came out on the strand. Soldiers, perhaps. A flash of lightning threw everything near me into violent relief. Two convicts. And directly an amazed voice exclaimed, "It's a miracle." It was the voice of Simon, otherwise Biscuit. And another voice growled, "What's a miracle? Why, there's a boat lying here. You must be mad, Simon. But there is, after all. A boat." They seemed awed into complete silence. The other man was Maffle. He spoke again, cautiously. "It is fastened up. There must be somebody here." I spoke to them from within the hovel. "I am here." They came in then, and soon gave me to understand that the boat was theirs, not mine. "There are two of us," said Maffle, "against you alone." I got out into the open, to keep clear of them for fear of getting a treacherous blow on the head. I could have shot them both where they stood. But I said nothing. I kept down the laughter rising in my throat. I made myself very humble, and begged to be allowed to go. They consulted in low tones about my fate, while with my hand on the revolver in the bosom of my blouse I had their lives in my power. I let them live. I. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.